In the last class, we referred to one verse which occurs in the second chapter, where the teacher of Gita explains the perfect equanimity of mind achieved by a spiritual aspirant who has reached steady wisdom through meditation. Now, one important problem which we have to encounter, the moment when we step into meditation, is the emergence of disturbing thought currents and impressions. That's why we have an instinctive fear of being alone. In fact, it is said that one characteristic of any spiritual aspirant is his ability to enjoy loneliness, being left alone. You can enjoy loneliness only when you feel peace within. Otherwise, we always want company, we want association. So very often, our mind is sometimes compared to a lake. You think of a lake or a pond, which is full of mud and filth. Accumulated mud and filth. And an attempt to meditate is like trying to remove the accumulated weeds and mud and filth with the help of a deep water probe. So when you try to stir the water, some of the accumulated dirt and filth and objects will come to the surface, and then we want to remove them. That's what we normally do when we clean a pond or a lake. Now, when we try to meditate, you find many of these thoughts and impressions will come to the surface. And as we go deeper and deeper, more and more accumulated impressions and tendencies and thought currents come to the surface. It is said that every spiritual aspirant has to encounter with the totality of all his accumulated impressions and tendencies, which he may have accumulated over hundreds of lives. Now, how to encounter them? Generally, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, which we will deal with later, and other books which deal with the science of meditation, teach us that we must assume the role of a spectator, not an actor, the role of somebody who sees all these things, a witness, without getting ourselves involved. So if you read the lives of great spiritual personalities, you find some of them were tempted by Satan, by the devil. You find Buddha had to encounter the tendencies and vasanas and vrittis. Vasanas means accumulated tendencies, the residual thought currents of past actions. He had to encounter all these. And you find the lives of Jesus Christ, that he was tempted by the devil. Actually, it means he had to encounter. When he tried to meditate, when he tried to introspect, he had to face the thought currents, which normally block our spiritual growth. Now, how to face them? As I said earlier, we had to assume a witness attitude towards these thought currents. We had to dissociate ourselves, detach ourselves completely from these thought currents. This is possible only if the spiritual seeker develops certain internal and external disciplines, which are explained in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. Patanjali was the great sage of ancient times who explained the path of Raja Yoga, of which meditation forms a very important factor. Dharana, Dhyana, meditation. So these are the three advanced states of meditative life, introspective life. Now, according to him, we have to develop five internal disciplines and five external disciplines. The five internal disciplines are collectively called Yama. And the five external disciplines are collectively called Niyamas. So Yama means many aspects of inner life. Ahimsa, Satya, Asteya, Brahmacharya, Abhigraha. This is Sanskrit term. In English we mean an attitude of non-violence, an attitude of truthfulness, and then an attitude of non-covetousness, an attitude of complete chastity, physical, mental, intellectual, at all levels, and then complete freedom from greed or a desire for accepting things given by others. I shall explain this one after another. Many of you may be practicing yogasanas. You will be surprised to know, in Patanjali's scheme, asanas plays a very, very minor role. Patanjali defines asanas as sthira sukham asana, a posture which enables you to sit for a long time in a relaxed, pleasant mood. That's what he means by asana. But that is very important in meditative life. And some of you may be familiar with other terms. See, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. These are the eight steps which Patanjali explains in his Science of Meditative Life or Raja Yoga. Of these, some points are very important in meditative life. In the Gita, you find apuryamanam achala pradishtam samudra mapa pravishanti yadut taddut kamayam pravishanti sarve sa shanti mapnoti na kama kami. This is the verse, the translation is this. He attains supreme peace. Who? The one who has completely controlled his senses, which means he can completely free himself from any involvement in the tendencies and impressions created by his actions, accumulated tendencies and impressions created or accumulated in previous life through actions, either verbal action, physical action, or any even a thought, mental action. Now, unless one gets fully established in these 10 disciplines, 5 internal disciplines and 5 external disciplines, one should never try to practice physical exercises like complicated yogasanas and pranayamas, breathing exercises. If I explain to you, it will become very clear. You know, all these exercises, whether breathing exercises or complicated yogasanas, you know, they generate energy. That you know very well. They make your nervous system powerful, active. They generate plenty of surplus energy. That any of you who may have, even if you meditate for a long time, try to meditate. Even if you sometimes, you know, maybe because that particular day you have spent all the time in a peaceful mood, reading some good books, associating with holy thoughts, you may get perhaps a deep meditation, you may experience this. That day you may feel not only peace of mind internally, but also a lot of surplus energy you feel being created by this meditative process. Now, it is very important for any spiritual aspirant to know how to make proper use of the surplus energy. It is a very important. So those who teach advanced techniques of yogasana, especially the famous two famous books are the Gheranda Samhita and Hatha Yoga Pradipika. These are the two famous books connected with this. Now, and other great sages, they insist on one point. Unless one gets fully established in some of the internal disciplines, one should not spend too much time in learning advanced techniques of breath control and yogasanas. The reason is, through practicing internal and external disciplines, you are blocking the doors through which this energy may flow towards negative channels. Give an example. A man or a woman or anybody who is extremely greedy, running after wealth, if he practices deep meditation, tries to practice deep meditation, a lot of negative ideas will come to the surface. Or if he practices any of these breath control, any of the disciplines associated with meditative practices, you know what really happens? The energy generated through these practices will flow towards certain channels which will make him more greedy. If he's a greedy man, if he practices all these disciplines, it will intensify his greed. On the other hand, through the practice of asteya, it is called asteya and aparigraha, two disciplines, Sanskrit is called, in English it means non-covetousness is asteya, means complete freedom from greed. And again, not accepting gifts from others. That is a psychological, it is related to human psychology. When you go on accepting things from others, it means you want even external comforts which are not essential for leading a spiritual life. That means too much of greed. If a greedy man practices too much of, if he tries to practice too much of meditation or too much of yogic exercises, what really happens, you know, is greed gets intensified. And if a man who is naturally violent, if he practices pranayama, you know, what happens? He becomes more nervous, more restless, and these violent tendencies may get intensified. So whatever may be, whatever are your natural tendencies and vasanas, will be intensified, will be sharpened because of or due to the surplus energy created in either breathing, breath control, yogic exercises, or meditative practices. So, the great scientist Patanjali says, first, you must block the channels through which surplus energy flows to lower channels. So, ahimsa means non-violence. So, try to be established in the ideal of ahimsa, then practice spiritual practices, then go for spiritual practices, then there will be no problem. So try to be established in truthfulness, then if you go for spiritual practices, you will be established, you will be intensive, you will be more established in truthfulness. Again, non-covetousness. To avoid the problem of greed, we block the door towards which energy may flow towards through negative channels. So, non-covetousness, one becomes completely contented. And then brahmacharya means controlling of human senses, mechanical sensory actions in a general way. Regulator controls sensory. And aparigraha means, if anyone goes about accepting gifts from everyone, his desire for these gifts will increase more and more. And this great psychologist Patanjali points out that if you accept gift from anyone, the one who gives you gifts will psychologically influence your actions and your mind. If you accept anything from anyone, the giver's tendencies and characteristics will be transferred to the receiver's mind. This often happens. How this works psychologically, one can very well imagine. You feel indebted to somebody who has given you a gift. So that feeling of indebtedness may psychologically enslave you. And indirectly, the giver will start influencing your mind. So the great scientist, psychologist Patanjali says, one must first of all try to get fully established in certain important internal disciplines. Disciplines which are very important in developing an integrated personality. As I said earlier, all kinds of spiritual practices at the beginning stage generate energy. And certain exercises like breath control and yoga will generate heat also. So before we start practicing these things, we must keep the doors open, the doors through which the surplus energy is channelized towards creative, constructive purposes. So according to yoga psychologists, the surplus energy created through through practice of meditation and yogic exercises is like a fuel which will take you all the way towards up to samadhi, the highest spiritual goal. But it will take you through the proper channel to the highest spiritual goal only if the surplus energy is directed, channelized to proper channels. And before that, the channels then through which surplus energy may flow to lower levels should be blocked. So one should get fully established in non-violence, non-covetousness, absence of greed, truthfulness, all this. At least every spiritual seeker should try to develop these qualities. Then meditative practice becomes more natural and more easy and more real. Very often, when we practice meditation, what really happens, depending upon the occasion, emotionally we feel a kind of a feeling of joy and happiness and blissfulness. But then, just after that, we feel we experience a feeling of emptiness, a vacuum. That's because we are not able to sustain the feeling of blissfulness that we experience in meditation. It is possible to sustain this experience of blissfulness if we first get established the internal discipline. Now, if anyone gets fully established in these internal disciplines, then naturally that person will get established in external disciplines also. Shauja tapas swadhyaya ishvara pranidhana. This means shauja sandosha tapas swadhyaya ishvara pranidhana. In English, tapa means, shauja means purity, cleanliness, internal cleanliness and external cleanliness. That is very important. So, if one gets established in discipline, then he should try to get established in external discipline. Means he should try to keep his body, his mind pure, clean, free from unhealthy and spiritual thoughts. Santosha means contentment. That we already explained in the earlier session when we are dealing with the characteristics of a spiritual seeker who has reached steady wisdom, is the Pragnalakshana. Normally, highly elevated souls will have a feeling of inner contentment. That contentment is entirely different from the feeling of satisfaction that we normally experience when we get something empirical. See, a businessman when he's able to make profit, or a professional who gets a promotion, or a student who gets a high grade, or a job seeker who gets a good job, it gives a kind of satisfaction, joy. But then that joy is momentary. After getting the job, he will start trying to get a higher job, which means he's satisfied, but he also feels there is something more to be achieved. He feels a businessman may get a good profit, but even if he gets billions of dollars, after some time again, he finds that there is another businessman who is making still more profits. So he also wants to get much more profits, which means he's satisfied, but that satisfaction is only relative. It is better than having better than incurring losses, no doubt. So it is not contentment. It is not inner contentment. It's only satisfaction. So inner contentment implies a feeling that I have got something more than this. I need not. I have nothing else to achieve. A kind of inner sense, a blissful attitude. You feel that there is nothing more to seek for, nothing more to be sought after, to be aimed at, to work for. That is one of the important characteristics of any spiritual seeker who tries to meditate. In fact, if anyone meditates and if he gets a glimpse of this inner contentment, an inner deep-rooted joy, well, I'm getting something. Beyond this, there is nothing that I can get. Well, I may get more of this inner contentment, but he won't seek for anything else. He may continue his spiritual practices. He won't stop. A little inner contentment you may have got, but you should not stop. But you feel that, well, there is nothing greater or higher or more satisfactory that I can achieve in this life. And that encourages the seeker to go deeper in spiritual life. So, shauja santosha. Tapa means concentration, natural concentration of senses and mind. Is called tapa. In other words, whatever we consider to be our ideal, we naturally concentrate on that. So, a sportsman concentrates very well. He has a very high level of concentration on all topics related to sports. When he practices, when he watches sports programs, you ask him to stop watching the TV and go to some other work, he'll be reluctant because he's so much concentrated. So all of us can focus our mind on something. There is nobody in the world who is not interested in anything. And we naturally focus our mind on the subject in which we are naturally interested. Now, Patanjali says, we must make an effort to change the focus of our attention, focus of interest, that is, towards spiritual life, towards ideas related to spiritual life. That's a prescription which he gives. So, and then then another very important discipline, and that I have already referred to, swadhyaya. In Sanskrit, swadhyaya means concentrated, devoted reading of good books. Doesn't necessarily mean any particular religious work as such. Any book which gives you a feeling of elevation, a feeling of sublimity, a feeling of supreme blissfulness. All great religious books in the world contain noble ideas. So such ideas we can imbibe by reading. The point is, the senses which are naturally going, which are naturally interested in going towards external objects, objects of sensory pleasure, these senses somehow should be diverted towards objects which take you closer and closer to a spiritual idea. That's the only point. And devoted reading of sacred books is a great help in spiritual life, because that brings, that fills your mind with creative ideas, sublime spiritual ideas, which will reduce the conflicts when you try to meditate. Because whatever we read, whatever association we make, either through eyes or through any of these senses, will leave an impression in the mind. And we, when we try to meditate, this impression will come to the surface. So try to accumulate in your mind spiritually helpful, healthy thought currents. And good, reading of good books is one great help. And for those who believe in God, there are people who don't believe in God, they also can meditate. But those who believe in God, for them there is one great help. But your idea of God should be the idea of a of an omnipresent, omnipotent, immanent reality who is merciful and who is manifest, who is present in all living beings, who is the indweller in all living beings. If one can surrender oneself to such a supreme reality, that also will reduce the conflicts arising in the mind when we try to meditate. In the 12th chapter, Lord Krishna makes a statement that an ability to face all worldly experiences with a supreme sense of equanimity of mind is the most important characteristic of a spiritual seeker who has achieved steady wisdom. Sri Krishna makes this point. Now, in his commentary on these verses, the great commentator of Bhagavad Gita, Shankaracharya, makes a point that these supreme characteristics, like facing the pleasant and unpleasant experiences with the same equanimity of mind, not being disturbed or perturbed by pain and pleasure, these are some of the characteristics of a highly evolved spiritual seeker. Now, these are the characteristics which are natural for an advanced soul, but these are the same characteristics which every spiritual aspirant who is a beginner in spiritual life should try to cultivate in his character. But when we cultivate these characteristics, when we try to make them part of our character, it should become natural to us. See, one great exponent of Gita, Lokamanya Tilak, he wrote for some famous book in Gita, he compares the natural characteristics of a spiritual seeker who developed these qualities and an ordinary man who tries to face problems with equanimity of mind. If you read Dale Carnegie's How to Make Friends in Business and all that, you know how to talk to your friend and how to interact, how to be, you should know how, what your friend may be interested in, you should start the conversation on that subject. So all these things, you know. But the other man also may have read Dale Carnegie. So he'll understand that we are playing these tricks. And so that kind of practice, the programmed imitation won't take us one inch forward in spiritual life. We should really try to cultivate them as part of our inner character. So that's why the teacher of Gita says, a spiritually evolved seeker, spiritual aspirant, may be established in perfect equanimity of mind, but he is not callous, He is not unresponsive. He never reacts to any situation. He reacts to situations. He becomes very active in this world. But at the same time, mentally, he is free from all disturbances. Remember, complete inaction is not a sign of spirituality. On the other hand, some of the greatest spiritual personalities, most of them, were hyperactive. They were living in this world, trying to help the world, trying to help people, every minute of their life. But still they faced all their dilemmas and crises in their life with perfect equanimity of mind. So this, one should not deliberately try to practice this as an artificial characteristic. One should really try to make them our natural characteristics, not artificial characteristics. See, a trained hotel receptionist, please, no offense meant, or a trained air hostess or trained sales executive will be able to talk nicely and will be able to keep his voice in a balance all the time. But in his mind, he will be full of tension and stress. That's why many of the top executives fall victims of hypertension, BP, and all this. Because they don't get a chance to express the inner tension and stress. There is an attempt to suppress them and put up a good face outside. So this dichotomy causes a lot of tension. Rather, it increases tension. It intensifies stress and tension and mental agony. And that leads to greater problems, more and more problems, more and more psychosomatic problems. So what the teacher of Gita says is one should try to make these characteristics our natural characteristics based on the theoretical understanding. First, theoretical understanding that the Supreme Reality, you may call God or whatever you want, is one. It is present everywhere. It is the immanent reality in everything. It is transcendent. It is omnipresent, and it is also the all-pervading omnipotent reality in this world. So this is a very interesting point. Now, as a spiritual seeker increases his efforts more and more, he is able to face whatever problems may arise in his mind as a witness and not as a spectator. Some great authors, as I said earlier, have compared human mind to a lake. So different layers of weeds, filth, dirt are accumulated in the lake. So when you try to clean up this lake with the help of a deep water probe, some sharp, a long stick, when you try to stir it, dirt and filth and all will come to the surface. Now, when they come to the surface, one should be very careful not to identify with them. See, people who meditate, sometimes the beginning, who are not aware of this, suddenly they feel great joy, suddenly they feel great depression. They experience depression because some of the thought currents which come to the surface are very unpleasant, sometimes be very shocking. So there are many, many people who have to work day and night, who have to put up long hours of hard labor every day. So when they meditate, sometimes the associations and the ideas that he may have encountered in his daily life may come to the surface. It's a very common experience. Now, how to confront them? As I said, we should practice the witness attitude. But to be able to practice witness attitude, we must try to think of ourselves as something which is not at all related to any of these tendencies and actions. This is not easy, because the moment you try to meditate, all these thought currents will come. thoughts related to our own actions, thoughts related to events in which we also were participants. So naturally, it is not easy to completely dissociate ourselves, to divorce ourselves from them. So the one way is to think of ourselves as the supreme consciousness, the all-pervading reality, which is not related to any of these actions. And in Sanskrit language, in the terminology of Gita, the great teacher of Gita says that this supreme consciousness is immanent in everything. Aham atma guda kesa sarva bhuda se sthidaha aham adischa madhyamcha bhudanam andayavaja. There is a verse here, meaning is this: Lord Krishna addresses Arjuna, the student, the disciple. He says, I am present in all living beings, as the beginning, as the middle, and as the end. Now, this reality, I here means, by the word I, Lord Krishna doesn't mean a human being or anything in the form, in with a form or a shape or a name. It means the omnipresent, the immanent, the transcendental reality, which is present everywhere. That is present in everything in this world. And it is the middle, it is the end, and also it is the transcendental reality also. So, this reality is different from this body. This body comes and goes. This body is associated with so many actions in this life. And this individual soul in another body was associated with so many actions in previous life. But this individual soul, according to Vedanta, is the same as the omnipresent, transcendental, immanent reality. And this reality is free from all these actions. So, we are in no way related to any of these actions. So, if one can keep this in mind, it's called a witness attitude, then one can mentally divorce himself from all tendencies and thought currents which come to the surface. After getting a full theoretical understanding of this, if you practice yoga, if you practice breath control, if you practice hatha yoga, if you practice meditation, you will face less conflicts. At the beginning, it may be only an intellectual conviction. But as we go further and further, this intellectual conviction becomes stronger and stronger and becomes a matter of practical experience. That's what really happens. Before getting this knowledge and before getting fully established in the internal and external disciplines, one should try to meditate, but one should keep in mind that these values are necessary. At least one should read and then practice. Then slowly, a spiritual aspirant can get more and more fully established in these internal and external disciplines. Another very important point that Krishna makes in this chapter is that is also related to spiritual meditative life. That is trying to explain this. That is the last verse of that portion of Gita that we are discussing. Esha Brahmi Sthiti Partha Nainam Prapya Vimukhyati Sthitvasyam Antakalevi Brahma Nirvanam Vichyati. Lord Krishna says, this highest spiritual state of one who has reached the highest wisdom in spiritual life is called the state of dwelling in Brahman. Having attained it, you can never be deluded. And by abiding in that state, even by the time of death, one is united with Brahman. The idea is this. As I said earlier, in Vedantic tradition, life is not one. Existence at the macro level, the cosmic level, and also the micro level, at the individual level, is analyzed in cycles. It's not one life. So I have to repeat this in this context again. Even a little bit of practice, either by way of reading a holy scripture or meditating for a little time, for a few minutes every day, or some kind of association with spiritual ideas, will have a lasting effect in one's life. And this will ultimately be beneficial in one's spiritual life. In the beginning of the second chapter, the 13th verse or so, Krishna says, this body undergoes 6 changes, but the soul is free from any of these changes. So, according to Vedantic tradition, we are a soul with a body and not a body with a soul. We are a soul with a body. This soul has to manifest. It needs a vehicle. It needs an instrument. And this body is the instrument. This body comes and goes. So, whatever actions we have performed in this life, in this subtle form, will remain and they will act again in the next life. This is called, sometimes called, you know, subtle body, sukshma sharira. In Vedantic parlance, I can give a brief explanation of this before proceeding further. In Vedantic tradition, the supreme reality is one. Sometimes it is called Atman as the immanent reality. It is called Brahman as the cosmic reality. As the origin of the universe, as the sustaining principle of the universe, as the ultimate culmination of the universe, it is called Brahman. And the same Brahman as the indweller, as the immanent reality, the immanent principle, which is residing in all living beings, is called Atman. There is no difference. Well, sometimes it compared, see, space within a pot and a space outside the pot. Suppose you have a pot here. The pot outside, sorry, the space outside the pot appears to be limited within the pot. But actually, this pot is impermanent. Pot comes into existence today and it vanishes today. When it comes into existence, it gets a particular shape, we call it a pot. So it has a shape, a form, and a name. But you break it, then the space within the pot gets merged with the space outside the pot. Outer space is called Bahakasha, the inner space is called Ghatakasha. That I won't go into those technical words. So the space within the pot and the space outside the pot are the same. Similarly, the Atman, the immanent principle which is residing in every living being, is the same as the omnipresent and the transcendental principle which is all-pervading, which is present everywhere. Now, according to the shape of the vessel with a pot or pan, whatever it is, you feel the space is limited into it. Now, every human being is trying to manifest more and more his identity with the supreme reality. And the more we manifest, the more spiritually enlightened we become. So Swami Vivekananda made a very interesting remark, a classic statement. He says, the difference between an amoeba and a Buddha is one of degrees, not of kind. He says the same supreme spiritual principle is present in an amoeba, which we can't see with naked eyes, and also in a Buddha, who is the embodiment of enlightenment. So what's the difference? In a Buddha, this divine omnipresent reality is manifesting in full effulgent form. In amoeba, it is manifesting in a very, very limited form. So, all actions, all words, all spiritual practices, including meditation, are only attempts to manifest more and more of this inner reality. Now, as I said earlier, This is in Vedantic tradition. Life is not a straight line progression. It is eternal. In the sense a cycle is eternal. As a circle or cycle, whatever it is eternal. Within it, there you can't say where it begins, where it ends, and which is its middle part. So, in the beginning of the second chapter, Lord Krishna says, this body comes and goes, it undergoes all the changes. Dehinosmin yatha dehe kaumaram yavanam jara tatha dehantra praptihi dhiras tatrana mukhyati. Krishna says, dhira means somebody who has reached a very high level of spiritual illumination. He is not worried, he is not deluded by whatever happens to this body. Because he understands that this body comes and goes. It is born, it grows, it decays, and it dies out. But there is something which remains imperishable. Now, here the question arises. Atman is imperishable and his body dies. How can we inherit the actions and the tendencies of previous life? So the Vedanta says there is a subtle body constitution. It is not visible. It consists of eight principles. Eight principles are the five senses, perception, five senses of action, five elements, five vital energies, are called Pancha Pranas, and then mind, memory system, and then our sense of identity, plus our ignorance that we are not the Supreme Reality, the ignorance which comes out of the conviction we are just this body. And as a result of this conviction, we indulge in different actions due to desires. Avidya, Kama, Karma. In Sanskrit, it's called Pancha Jnanendriyani, Pancha Karmendriyani, Pancha Mahabhudas, then Pancha Pranas, Antakaranas, Avidya, Kama, Karma. Well, I have already explained the eight groups. Five senses of perception, one. Five senses of action, another. Five vital elements, another unit. And five vital energies, Pancha Pranas, vital energies and vital elements. So total four units, plus the mind, mental, intellectual system, psycho intellectual system, which is called, you know, the mind with which we identify things, the intellect with which we recognize things, and the memory where we retain past impressions, and our own ego sense. This is another fifth one. Then our desire, sixth one, and then the actions in which we indulge ourselves because of desire, seventh one. The eighth one is our ignorance of the supreme truth, that we are not just these bodies. We are something beyond this body. So these eight units together, they continue to exist even after our death. One may ask the question, five senses and five senses of action and five senses of perception, they'll be destroyed in this life. How can they continue to exist after this death? Well, what about tendencies and vasana, tendencies and attitudes that we accumulate in our mind? See, eyes do not continue to exist after the body is gone. But the impressions that we have gathered in this life with our eyes will continue to exist. If you find people with strong obsession, some strong convictions, which they start displaying right from the early days, it is, according to Vedanta, the result of previous actions, previous tendencies accumulated in actions in previous life. Extreme fear, extreme phobia, extreme attachment, all these are accumulated, the result of accumulated tendencies and impressions. So, the external part of human body may perish in this life, but the impressions and tendencies they bring to the mind will continue to exist. So, all these continue to exist in every life, in every incarnation, in every rebirth. The moment we realize that we are not these psychophysical mechanisms, we are something beyond all this. We are the omnipresent, immanent, transcendental reality. The moment we experience the supreme truth, that moment this chain is broken. In other words, we are what we are. But intellectual conviction won't do. It should be translated into experience. It is true in a sense, you know, one said, philosopher said, we are what we are, that is true. But not at intellectual level, at the experience level. And this intellectual conviction becomes a matter of experience only through spiritual exercises like meditation. Meditation, in other words, is the art of translating an intellectual conviction into real experience. Because intellectual conviction is only a theory. But an intellectual conviction should be translated into a matter of real inner experience. And meditation is one important tool. But before meditation becomes really effective, we have to try to imbibe, try to cultivate these characteristics and qualities and attributes. As I said, a complete sense of non-violence, non-covetousness, inner purity, contentment, and association with noble and spiritually elevating ideas. Through these exercises, we fill our mind with good impressions and tendencies. And then when we try to meditate, this impression will come to the surface. If you read the life of a great saint, or if you read the life of any noble, sublime human character, and then try to meditate that evening, you find your mind will throw up some of these ideas. This is that's what really happens. And slowly, our mind will try to imbibe these qualities, some of these qualities, through meditation. Otherwise, the problem is, there will be always a dichotomy, a conflict between our attempt to meditate and the thought currents and impressions which come to the surface in the course of meditation. So these negative thought currents and impressions can be countered only by creating positive thought currents and tendencies. And this can be done either by reading good books, associating with people whose presence and whose words will spiritually elevate you, will be helpful in spiritual life, or by somehow associating with places and persons and ideas which are helpful in spiritual life. So now we will have meditation for half an hour. After that, we will discuss the subjects. Today I have taken up a new topic which are very relevant in meditative life, yama, niyama. You can clarify whatever ideas which you want to be clarified in the course of interaction. So we will meditate. Any topic.
I think you've said this, but the yama and the niyama, those practices, can you just list again what those practices are, the inner and the outer?
Yes. Yama and yama. Yama includes five virtues, inner disciplines, which which are related to our convictions, ideas, more subtler. First one is ahimsa, means non-violence. Not only non-violent action, non-violent thought. One should be establishing non-violent thought, non-violent action, non-violent word. One should not do anything violent verbally, physically, or even mentally, a violent thought. That also will create a tendency. Even a flash thought current will create a tendency. And the tendency will come to the surface. It can influence our character. And this later becomes action. And any spiritual practice or attempt to do any spiritual practice, especially meditation and much more important, this asanas and pranayama, it intensifies whatever tendencies we have got within us. So first tendency should be purified. So the first one is ahimsa. Ahimsa means non-violence. Non-violent thought, non-violent act, non-violent word. Verbally, mentally, or physically, we should not do anything which is violent. Second one is satya, truthfulness. Satya means truthfulness. That is, of course, clear. Its grossest definition is keeping mental ideas, mental thoughts, thoughts, action, and word on a straight line. It is not only factual truth, but truth as a value. You know. That's it. Asteya, and the third one, that is non-covetousness. Literal meaning is non-stealing. That's, you know, it's an ancient scripture. So it belongs to maybe 5th century or 4th century BC. But its meaning should be taken as non-covetousness. Brahmacharya means chastity. Those who are not established in some kind of inner purity of sensory pleasure, and if they practice any of these, that tendency, that negative tendency, will become stronger, intensified. See, somebody who is not establishing non-violence, if he practices any of these disciplines, he may become much more violent. Because nervous energy is created by pranayama and other things. Energy generated. So this energy will activate whatever tendencies we have got. See, if our tendency is peaceful, calm, and conducive to spiritual life, then this energy generated will flow through creative channels. We will try to study more, we'll contemplate more effectively. And that will help us in spiritual life. Otherwise, it will push us backward from spiritual growth. So, aparigraha literally means not accepting of gifts. But as an extended interpretation, we must include having not desire for anything which doesn't belong to us. Otherwise, what happens? Greed will increase. A greedy man, if he does a lot of pranayama and if he meditates and all that, you know, that the greed, the desire for other people's things and desire for accepting things from others, it will increase. And there is another psychological reason. When we accept things from others, in modern times you can say things which are not necessary. Going about, accepting things, accumulating things which are really not necessary. I mean, it becomes a kind of philosophy of life, beating things, accumulating things. That may be harmful in spiritual life. So whatever tendency you have got, that tendency gets much more invigorated. It gets intensified. It gets stronger by any of these practices. These are inner disciplines, internal or inner. The second group is niyama. Niyama means shaucha. Shaucha Sanskrit, it means cleanliness or purity. Physical purity, cleanliness, and also mental inner purity. Physical purity will convince that any number of times we may take bath, but still the body is uproar. You know what body is? Body is an instrument, is a noble instrument, a positive, noble instrument for achieving higher things in life. So that way body is necessary. Body is certainly a very effective, useful instrument. It's a positive outlook. But still body should not be an object of worship. Body is necessary. Body should be kept healthy, kept in good condition. But all people who turn to spiritual life begin their spiritual journey with the conviction that there is something beyond this body. Otherwise, we won't take the spiritual life. So that's the first step. So it should be kept clean, but it should not become an object of worship. And inner purity tendencies, impressions, so thoughts, they can be kept pure by welcoming only good thoughts, pure thoughts into our mind. Second one among niyama is santosha, it means contentment, a kind of inner contentment. If we don't have a sense of inner contentment, and then if you practice any of these, what happens? It can lead to greed, desire for external things, going on accumulating external things. So, accumulation of transitory external pleasure becomes goal of life. To prevent that from developing in our mind, we must practice a sense of value of inner contentment. Tapaha actually means concentration. In fact, it actually means bringing mind and senses of perception on a single focus. Concentration. Tapaha means concentration. And austerity. A little bit of austerity. Austerity means well, it depends upon our walk of life, our own way of life, external austerities. Reading sacred books or going on pilgrimage or associating with holy places, holy thoughts. Depends upon one's own convictions and professional life. So, then the fourth one is, fourth element in niyama categories, swadhyaya. In Sanskrit it is called, means, literally it means reading of good, spiritually helpful books with proper understanding of meaning and concentration. This is the literal, this is the somewhat Sanskrit, so the English translation of the Sanskrit commentary. With a sense of reverence, we must read books. It need not necessarily be religious books, for those who don't believe in religion. It could be any sublime book, which gives us a positive feeling in our mind. And the fifth one in the niyama category is meant for those who believe in God. Ishvara Pranidhana. For those who believe in God, it is very easy. It's a kind of surrender to God. This is very easy for those who are believers in God. A kind of self-surrender to God. Because that that helps us to remind ourselves of our spiritual goal. That strong conviction, God means, but God should be understood as the embodiment of all great attributes like mercy, compassion, and as the indweller, as the inner principle, which is immanent in every living being, which is omnipresent. A God who doesn't exclude anybody from his kingdom. A God who accepts all, welcomes all, the embodiment of mercy. That's it. So these are the 10 disciplines.
Thank you.
This one may not be able to achieve completely, but even if one, even if a spiritual aspirant becomes fully convinced of the relevance and importance of these values, it will help him in spirit. That's all. And meditate well.
I have a question. I think I understand about the problems of receiving gifts and how it can influence you. My practice is Tibetan Buddhism. So one of the paramitas is generosity. So I'm trying to figure out, in order for me to give you something, you have to take something. So how do I practice generosity, which my understanding is an important thing. And
yes, yes.
Not to get this.
Really, it need not be a frightening position. The idea is, one should practice philanthropy and generosity to people. The idea is, one should not make accepting and accumulating things from others, things which are not really necessary for our life. You can give any amount, in fact that will help you in spiritual life. Receiving is aparigrahamish, receiving, non-receiving. Aparigrahamish, non-receiving. The Sanskrit word is aparigraha, non-receiving of gifts. In that case, we may feel, if I give somebody a hungry man, if I give him food, I am doing a terrible harm to him, because by receiving my help, he may be spiritually injured. We should not feel that way. It will help us. It will help us. Any act of generosity, philanthropy, compassion, and mercy. In fact, it will create a great transformation in our life. You find any, even simplest act of generosity or mercy or compassion is like investing something in our spiritual bank, which will help us in spiritual life. It purifies the tendencies, our impressions. Any other subject?
On a different topic than you talked tonight, does the Gita address why Brahman needed to create all this to begin with? I mean, what purpose or?
Excuse me, Brahman.
Oh, why does the Gita address why Brahman created all this world?
Brahman created this world.
Well, yeah.
Oh.
Or why? Or
yes, Gita has got different interpretations, different commentaries by those who are non-dualists. And also those who are monotheists, dualists, and so on. According to Shankaracharya's commentary, Gita is essentially a book on non-dualism, because Arjuna's problem was due to his ignorance, his delusion, his wrong notion that he was this body. Mm-hmm. So that is the foundation of his wrong notion. He was this body, nothing other than that. And as for creation, according to Advaita, you find the last word in Advaita is creation is unreal. Now, this is the last word. But I shall explain, creation is unreal. I shall explain this point. According to Advaita, you can consider something as real only if it is eternal, if it is, if it remains the same in the past, present, and future, and if it remain, if it is experienced as the same in the waking, dream, and deep sleep stage, and if it remains the same at all times, no, is there anything in this world which remains the same in the past, present, and future? If you think of the world as real, where was the world before it was created? Creation means the birth of something, which means it did not exist before it was born. And anything which is created, by logical analysis, it will cease to exist. Which means it will change its shape and form. That part. You know, it won't be destroyed once for all. It will change its shape and form. And we know after a few billions of years, the earth won't be what it is right now. It was not like this maybe 10 billion years back. This is from Advaiti point of view. Now, is there something in this world which is real for all times? You can call it real only if it was not created. So, Brahman is the only reality which is real in the real sense of the term, because it was never created, because there was never a time when it did not exist. That's what Advaita says. So the world in its subtle form is, in its real, in the real form is Brahman itself. But in its name and form, it is relative. I shall explain this with the help of a simple example. Well, you think of gold and golden ornaments. Now, when it has got a particular shape, you call it a necklace. So it has got a name, necklace, and it has got a shape. Now, as gold, it is real. But as necklace, it is only relative, because it was created, manufactured by a goldsmith on a particular day. And if you melt it, it can become something else. So it is only relative. So unreal here means relative. When we say the world is unreal, creation is unreal, it means relative. This is the metaphysics in Advaita Vedanta. Look, I am just giving a simple explanation. So everything in this world is real, as gold is real, but as necklace it is only relative. This is the Advaita argument. In a way it is true. You think of clay and pots and pans made of clay. When did the clay come into existence? Sorry, when did the pot come into existence? On a particular day. And you break it, it will cease to exist. So before it was manufactured, it was not pot, it was only clay. And when you break it, it will go back to clay. And so when the clay is sitting, when the pot is sitting in front of you, then also it is nothing but clay only, with a name and form. This is Advaitic philosophy, which I didn't deal with the technical idea behind. So according to Advaita, according to Sri Krishna, according to teacher of Gita, the world is real only in a relative sense. That's why, that's a sense in which I said that world is unreal. Not really real, but only relatively real. That's the idea behind. This is what Advaita says. It may sound a bit puzzling, if a puzzle for a beginner, but, well, you just think of the world in which we are living. Is it really real in the absolute sense? If you want to call it real in the absolute sense, it should remain in the same shape, same form for all times. Then only you can call the world that we experience, the world in which we live, the world of which we are a part, is real. Is it really real? After 3 billion years, it may change the shape, everything may change. So the pot is broken, it becomes clay. Before it was pot, it was clay. And even if he's sitting in front of you, then also it is actually not different from clay. The clay plus the shape of hand. And when it gets a new shape, it gets a new name also. This is Advaita metaphysics. I'm not coming into that because that is a higher metaphysics that is explained to Upanishads and other higher metaphysical works in Sanskrit language. We are dealing with the subject in Old Temple every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock every Friday. Mm-hmm. The class will start from next Friday onwards. So you are welcome to join. But I am not coming to that subject in this book. Because once you read Advaita, once you read a book on non-dualistic philosophy, then it becomes very simple. We just use our reason. Look around. But it doesn't deny God. You have to remember, Advaitic metaphysics does not deny God. It accepts God. But it says, God, as we go further and further, as we spiritually and philosophically as we evolve and go higher and higher, we understand God is not somebody who sits in, who creates this world and sits somewhere apart from this world. God is the immanent reality present everywhere. Not only human beings, in all living beings, everything. So there is no place where God is not present. There is nothing in this world of which God is not a manifestation. God is a manifestation. Everything. So it is all pervading. God is all pervading. God is immanent, also transcendent. But the idea is, we are not coming to that subject in this Gita. We are dealing with meditation. But if one can meditate after becoming familiar with the idea that this omnipresent, omniscient, all-merciful reality is present in me, and by meditation, by purifying my thoughts, my actions, and my words, I can manifest this divinity more and more. So all spiritual practices become tools for manifesting this reality. The greatest spiritual personalities the world has seen, all whether Buddha or Jesus or Shankaracharya or Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, all the great spiritual personalities are people who have manifested this reality. Not only the so-called spiritual personalities, all great men, those who feel for others. If you take a person whom you may not call a saint, but you are very saintly, Abraham Lincoln, for example. Spiritual. So there is a fundamental distinction between spiritual and religious, according to Vedanta. You can be spiritual without being religious. That is the thesis of Bhagavad Gita and Vedantic books. Spirituality is universal. It is universal humanism. It encompasses, it embraces the entire humanity. It goes beyond what we normally call religion. There will be many great religious personalities who are spiritual. But spirituality goes beyond what we normally understand understand by the word religion. But in the true sense of the term, religion actually means spirituality, but not always, depending upon the interpretation and believers. That's right.
I have a minor question and maybe a little more of a major question. The minor question is, a lot of times I'll hear the language, each human is potentially divine, whereas, you know, it sounds like, and my understanding of Advaita is that, you know, it's not potentially, there's only that oneness, so how, there's no movement really, you're always divine.
Yes.
That's the minor question.
Swami Vivekananda says, you know, each soul is potentially divine. The idea is, he was addressing the common man living, common intellectuals living 19th century.
It's the lower truth versus the higher truth.
So if you tell that everyone is divine, there are many people, apparently you cannot see much divinity in them. There are many, and there are many people who, in whom we can see and experience this divinity. So addressing those intellectuals, Vivekananda had to use the word potentially. That's the idea. Because very often, the kinetic level, we may not always experience the divinity. We always don't see that divinity manifesting. So to accommodate that apparent contradiction, Swamiji says, each soul is potentially divine. And what we call religious practices, whether meditation or anything, these are attempts to bring out this divinity within. This idea behind. So, according to Advaita, even if you don't realize that you are the Brahman, you are Brahman only. The fact that you are the divine reality does not depend upon your understanding that you are the reality. Even if you don't understand, refuse to accept that you are the divine, you are divine. But then, for ordinary spiritual aspirants like you and me, all of us, we have to undergo certain disciplines to bring out this in actual practice, in our encounter with the external world. That's why the potential is used. Because Swamiji had to give this message to the world at large.
It's a convention for a lower truth for a leading.
If I tell you that we are all divine, we are real Atman, then you know, well, could you explain it? There are many people apparently not very divine. Apparently, they don't manifest much of their divinity. So to accommodate, potentially they are also divine, but the manifestation of the divinity needs some effort on our part. Good life, some discipline, yama, all discipline, we have already expressed this idea.
So that was the easier of the two questions, I think. I hope I hope the second question is even easier. I think it was Brahmananda who said something like, it's relatively easy to reach samadhi, but to stay there is tough. That's the trick. How, those moments of understanding of the oneness of everything, I might have those moments and then I slip out of it. I get lost in the Maya again.
Yeah.
And that's, for me, it feels like that's the central challenge, to not get caught up in the play and forget that I'm just an actor in that larger role. What are your recommendations about how to, stay, so to speak, in that higher state?
If we get that experience at least once, even once, we will be transformed. But then, does it mean that you will be always remaining the samadhi? You cannot come to this world, you cannot live, you cannot eat food, you cannot work in an office? Does it mean? And we continue living this world. The idea is our outlook towards this world, our understanding of the world, the way we look at the world will be totally different after getting this experience. And Vivekananda's guru, Sri Ramakrishna Paramahansa, gives an example. He says the difference between a highly elevated spiritual personality who has reached the samadhi level and leaves the world, and those who have not reached this level. The difference is this. He says, suppose a great actor is playing the role of a beggar in a film. He may get Oscar award and he may look much more beggarly, much more miserable looking than professional beggars in the streets. Then only he can get an award. But even when playing the role in the film or in a drama for that matter, he will know within him that he is not poor man. After the makeup is removed, he will go and stay in 5-star hotel. So the miserable looking beggar who looks so miserable looking on the stage, on the screen, actually within him, he knows fully well that he is not a beggar. He is a rich person, all actors. So similarly, a highly enlightened, evolved spiritual personality who has reached this experience. He will be living this world, but within him he will know that all these experiences are transitory. They are not everlasting. So shocks and critic dilemmas and crises will not shock him. Others will be swept off their feet by tragedies or by some unpleasant experiences. But an enlightened spiritual seeker will not be, who has reached this level of experience, will not be perturbed. That's only difference. That's the idea. I think it's clear. Now we have reached the end. So thank you all. You're free. Next time also you're free to ask whatever subjects you want to be discussed here. Peace, peace, peace.